Historic Kansas City recently gave out their annual awards for big projects that preserve important pieces of our city's architectural past. One of the award categories is adaptive reuse. That means turning a building meant for one thing into something else entirely. So like old warehouses being converted into lofts or an old bank, for example, becoming a library. This year's award for adaptive reuse is a 128-year-old church in KCK that's been converted into a boxing gym for kids. The church sat vacant for a long time before that. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're going to hear now from the retired police officer who took this on. He was once an altar boy at that church. Matt Tomasik, good morning.
Good morning.
So what are we talking about here is the Police Athletic League. And can you explain what that is, what you've been wanting to do?
Sure. So police athletic leagues have been around for over 75 years, and they're really prominent up east. We don't have a lot of them in this part of the country. But the concept is police using athletics to interact with kids. And through that interaction, you have mentoring and you know, kind of helping things go right. So I was born and raised in Strawberry Hill, Kansas City, Kansas, but after I graduated from school and was looking for a job, Kansas City, Missouri was hiring, Kansas City, Kansas wasn't. So I ended up in Kansas City, Missouri as a police officer. And the last 15 years of my career, I worked at the Westside CAN Center, which was community policing.
Kansas City, and also health services, right?
Yeah, for sure. But Kansas City, Missouri has a really robust PAL program. So through taking our kids from the West Side over to the PAL, to the programming they have, I saw how important it was and how effective it was.
Can you explain a little bit more what that program was doing?
So, you know, in its essence, in my opinion, what really solves crime is relationships. And what is going to turn the Queen Mary, so to speak, between what's going on with the police department and communities is one-on-one relationships. And so if your child is coming to us and we are mentoring and we're teaching them how to, in our case, throw a right hook or to garden or to
do something they want to do.
Yeah. So you're building relationships. You're not only, you know, you're not only helping kids, but you're also building relationships and reaping the benefits that come from that.
You guys had been wanting to do something like this for a while, and you just needed a space to do it in, to establish a police youth academy in KCK.
Sure.
I understand you were the one who was like, I have an idea. There's this church.
Well, so we were going to go into another space, and then that fell through. The chief, Terry Ziegler, and Mayor Alvey, we were going to go to another space, and that fell through, and then the church became an option for us.
So talk to me about the significance of this church in your community, in your life, why you were thinking, like, I can see this. I can see this 128-year-old church being exactly what we need.
Well, so in that, I don't know, two-mile area over there, there's six Catholic churches, or there were. And so the population base just couldn't support that.
Yeah, they did not need six Catholic churches anymore.
So St. Mary's was the first Catholic church in Wyandotte County. 1858 was when it started. Then it moved to that location in 1890. But it closed in the 80s. And it sat vacant and was kind of run down. So the notion that I think it's the same mission, actually, or really close. You know, what we're doing now is probably really similar to what was going on there a long time ago. We're building community. We're helping people.
But a building is ultimately, on some level, a physical space. And I'm curious about what it is about this space that made you. It's not totally intuitive to think church becomes boxing club.
Well, so, you know, the sport or the activity that we're doing is really the least important. That's just a mechanism to get the kids in the door. So if we're gardening, if we're sowing, if we're shooting bows and arrows or whatever. So, but it sets up really great for this. It's 38-foot ceilings. It's free span. It's an awesome, when you walk in, it's an awesome space with the stained glass.
I mean, this is the church you went to as a kid. What are your memories of it? Is that part of why you wanted to get in there and do something with it?
Well, so it's in Strawberry Hill, and Strawberry Hill is really close to my heart. But I grew up in I am a member of St. John the Baptist, which is a block and a half away. But living in the neighborhood, whenever they had an altar boy no-show, the nun knew that she'd call my mom, and my mom would send one of them, either me or my three brothers, up to fill in. So all of us were altar boys there as a kid. So I've been to many masses at St. Mary's.
And it meant something to you to see it take on new life? It's the mission that you have is really about community and neighborhood and forging a positive relationship between law enforcement and that community. But did you have some piece of you that was also like, it would be great to see this place alive again?
Yeah, you know, it's cool. You know, it's as I can't think of a better use for it. And it really is just, that's all I can say about it. It's really cool.
Had historic preservation been part of your goal? Because I understand there are a lot of little details that you have taken some pains to preserve. Was that your goal going in, or did that come about kind of as you went through this process?
You know, I didn't give it a whole lot of thought as far as historic preservation, other than I really wanted it to be like it was originally.
How had it changed?
I don't know how you could improve it by doing anything differently to it than putting it back the way it was.
So something had happened that had taken it from its original splendor?
So take, for instance, you know, I'm sure the interior walls have been painted 10 times in the last 100 years, but the paint in a lot of places it all needed to be scraped, and we started scraping, and we noticed the original frescoes behind the, 16th of an inch of paint that was on there. So we thought, man, it can't get any better than this. So we ended up scraping and grinding all the walls down and exposing the original walls from 1895 probably is when they put it up there.
What are the images in that fresco?
So there's a pattern around each window of squares and circles, and then above the altar, where the altar was in the dome, there's a sunburst. It's impressive.
Is it so? When you say that we were doing this, it's you and fellow police officers.
So it was myself and several volunteers and some police officers and some workers. And so,
do you remember the first kids who came into the space? Do you remember seeing those first arrivals of people actually using this old church again for the first time in so long?
I do, but what I remember most, well, a handful of things, but we've been open for since February 15th, and we have over 330 kids signed up to date. And I've had 7 parents come in and say, you know, can you help?
We are going to hear what's happening in that space now in some more detail in just a minute. We are back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm here with Matt Tomasik, director of the Police Athletic League in KCK, which just won top awards from Historic Kansas City for transforming a really old church into a boxing club for community youth. Hi again, Matt.
Hi.
So I do understand that you open the doors to this church-turned-boxing club every single weeknight.
Yeah, so we're open Monday through Friday from 5 to 8 o'clock.
How many people typically come in? Is it pretty busy?
Yeah, so it's a youth program, but we're averaging about 65 kids a night.
That's wild.
Yeah, for our boxing program, interestingly, about 30% of our kids that come are girls. So, and, you know, if you watch, you know, probably a third of the kids are there to learn how to competitively box. A third of the kids are there for exercise, and a third are there for social, to be social. And, you know, some nights kids jump in and out of different categories. It's been it was more kids than we anticipated, but it tells us that we're in the right spot and that we're doing the right things.
You were inspired by your experience taking kids in Kansas City, Missouri, over to Powell Gardens for gardening lessons?
No, to the Police Athletic League in Kansas City,
gotcha.
Missouri.
Okay. So, sorry, when you said Powell.
Yeah, Police Athletic League.
So, it's interesting to me that you chose boxing as you went into KCK. Can you talk a little? It does sound like you picked the right thing to bring kids in and do things on their own terms.
Sure. And boxing is, I guess, our flagship program. But the partnership with Golden Gloves, the demographic in Kansas City, Kansas, and as many people as love boxing, it was kind of a no-brainer.
And so when you think about the lessons that boxing has to teach beyond just the skill of boxing itself, what do you think about?
Well, I think that, again, it's the relationships. Like, our goal is, we're, like I said earlier, boxing is just a way to get the kids in the door. But with that said, we want to put a kid in the Olympics out of our boxing program. We want to put kids in the Ivy League as well. And we will do that through boxing, or using boxing as that mechanism.
And you've seen that in police athletic clubs. Athletic leagues, excuse me, in other cities?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. No question about it. I mean, this isn't a concept. This is something that, you know works on its surface. It's interaction. It's mentoring. It's caring about other human beings. It's, you know, helping things go right.
Can you tell a story of someone, of a kid who you've gotten to know and their family, either in your time working with the Police Athletic League in KCMO, or in just the couple months that the one in KCK has been open?
Well, in KCMO, they have a million stories. They've been doing it for a long time. And I have to say that without their help and guidance and assistance, we wouldn't be where we were at. I call those guys, you know, three times a week. How do you do this? How do you do that? But when I think the second night we were open, a mom came in and she had five kids with her five kids from 17 to 8 years old. And she said, can they come here? I don't feel comfortable with them playing out in the street. And I said, sure, no problem. Here, give them to us. A couple nights later, I gave two of her boys a ride home and I took them to their house. And I understand exactly what that mother felt, why she felt that way. I would, you know, it was just a really rough area. So a grandmother came in with her grandson. Her daughter had died, and she said, my son's really angry. He's 15 years old. He's really angry that his mom's not here. Can you help? And so here's a lady coming to the police department saying, can you help?
What does that mean to you personally? I mean, not just to be able to help, but that you are there as representing the police department as people in the community are coming to for help.
Well, I think that by and large, the vast majority of people who go into police work, that's why they do it. They do it to help people. They do it because they want to make a difference. So it seems very normal to me.
In your personal experience, you probably have to do a lot of the kind of another kind of thing as a police officer. You're helping, but you're arriving on the scene when something's already happened.
Yeah, you know, I think that you find that out really quickly as a police officer, that most of the time you're late. You know, you're there after the fact. So to be able to help almost in real time really makes you feel good.
Do you, now that you're up and running, do you think about your own childhood when parents are bringing their kids in and they're having their own experiences there?
I just think that this is a great program that is going to make a difference.
And that's what you feel?
Yep.
That's what's happening now. Matt Tomasik, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Matt is the director of Kansas City, Kansas's first police youth academy in an old church. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we'll hear about how other old buildings are taking on new life in just a little while on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we've been talking about the old church-turned-police athletic league in KCK that just got top honors for historic preservation. The award is for adaptive reuse, turning a building meant for one thing into a space for something new. I'm joined by Lisa Lastman Briscoe of Historic Kansas City, who gave this award, and the urban design expert Daniel Serta, who joins us periodically to talk about the larger meaning of projects like these. Hi to both of you.
Good morning.
Lisa, let's start off with you. Can you talk about this category of adaptive reuse and what it says about maybe some misconceptions out there about what historic preservation even is?
Well, as Matt described, adaptive reuse is where you're taking an existing project and you're looking at finding a new alternative use. In Matt's case, it's taking a church and converting it into an athletic facility versus looking at other more traditional commercial properties that could be, as you would be familiar in downtown, where we have a great resurgence of new loft facilities or loft residential living throughout many, many commercial traditional office buildings throughout Kansas City. So it's looking beyond the traditional uses of properties and thinking outside the box to how you can take more modern, more contemporary uses and applying those contemporary uses to existing fabric that can have new uses and new life and new vibrancy for an area.
I think a lot of people imagine that historic preservation is like that what you're doing is standing in front of a wrecking ball saying, no, don't do it. It's too pretty or something like that.
I often get accused of trying to stand in front of those bulldozers and protect those pretty buildings. No, preservation, that is the old 60s and 70s notion of what preservation is. Preservation, as Matt just described, he himself has the seeds of preservation, whereas he, in his own words, described, he didn't necessarily think about it as preservation, but as he started to look at that building, he had memories of it. He had feeling towards it. It was part of his culture, his life,
and he had an idea for what it could be.
He did, and you'll note in his quote was, he just wanted it to go back to what it used to be.
Daniel Serta, what are your thoughts as you listened to this story of an old church that had sat abandoned for some time, but it came back to life not as a church, but as something else, as a place where kids were going to learn boxing and where the police were going to try to forge relationships with the community and become sort of the helpers they had gotten into it wanting to be?
I'd go back to something that Matt said as well, which was, as you mentioned, that idea of relationships. And I think, you know, old buildings get looked at as everything from eyesores to a vestige of a past that isn't going to come back to, you know, just an obstacle. And
yeah, like don't tear it down. Why? Because I feel something about it, not because I have an idea for it.
Well, that's often the case, but it's just as often the case that people want something torn down because it's no longer active and it's no longer alive. And I think in what you heard Matt talking about is that vision for what it can be. And it's really based on that one touchstone of the past, which is the idea of relationships and the role that that institution, that that building as an institution played in the community life of that neighborhood.
You know, something interesting that he was pointing out, that part of what had inspired this is that this is a neighborhood in KCK where there used to be six Catholic churches all in a very short distance from one another, and that the community used to need six Catholic churches in a short distance from one another, but that it doesn't have the community to serve in that function anymore, not six of them. And so this one had been sitting empty, but that looking at the current needs of a community to fill these, there are things that are built for a specific purpose, and it can't really serve that purpose anymore. There isn't the need.
Exactly.
Well, and it's having the ability, as Matt did, to have the vision and not blame the building. Look at the building as, in many respects, we look at built environment and we don't necessarily see it for what it also can be. It is an existing built infrastructure of tremendous value to every community across every country. And it all's in the eye of beholder of whether or not demolition is permanent, and what each community's buildings offer is an authenticity of that particular place.
Can you say a little bit more? What do you mean when you say don't blame it on the building?
Well, it's as Daniel just said, it's all in how you look at it. So,
but don't blame what? Is there sort of a tendency in our culture for people to notice something, what something can't be, and get frustrated by that? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, you can look through decades of our urban planning history where, let's say, in the 60s, the big idea at the time was urban renewal. And in a sense, blaming the building, at least from my perspective, to remedy the problem, land clearance was the solution in wide sweeping miles of demolition. And it was thought at the time to be the best approach.
What do you see as the consequences of that?
Well, I think we can see the consequences of that in various cities throughout the community. And that was many decades ago. We have
since learned. Can you describe that consequence?
The consequence of clearance of significant blighting influences we have learned of leaving tremendous swatches of vacant land is just as blighting as the vacant building.
Daniel, what kinds of adaptive reuse are you seeing a lot of examples of right now?
Well, it's all over the board. I think at the essence of it, it's the idea of, again, having that vision, finding a creative way to make a new use of an old building. And within that is still that there are those touchstones. There are those tangible elements like Matt talked about, like they grinded off the paint and there were the murals underneath. But it's also bringing back life to that. So, there's a range of these. The common ones that you see that, again, I think a lot of people sometimes don't even necessarily think of as preservation per se. A lot of the downtown housing that's been created over the last decade or so is actually repurposing old office buildings that are basically functionally obsolete as office buildings, many of which have sat vacant for decades.
Why are they functionally obsolete as office buildings? Because there are a lot of businesses wanting to move downtown too.
It's interesting. The dynamics of something like the office market change. There's fashions and styles that come and go. You have open office. You have closed office. You have, a whole range of different approaches that take. One of the things I remember hearing all the time back in the 80s and 90s was these buildings just don't have the open floor plate that everybody's looking for. No company wants to be spread across 8 floors because, each floor can only accommodate about 15 people. There are actually many, many smaller enterprises now that can make use of smaller floor spaces like that. And again, if you convert it for a residential use, which people would have probably thought was absurd 20 years ago, you've created a very interesting environment for living.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And we've been talking about what urban planners and preservationists call adaptive reuse. But what really, when it comes down to it, is the creativity it takes to see the potential in something that wasn't always what you originally thought it would be. So when we think about something like the downtown library, which used to be a bank, and that old vault is now a place where you can go and see movies in a darkened space with this kind of cool history, that is adaptive reuse. But it's happening all over the city in a lot of kinds of buildings that don't have quite the cachet of the old bank vault, in really super interesting ways. And that's what we're talking about right now. Lisa Lastman-Briscoe of Historic Kansas City, welcome back.
Thank you.
And hello again to you, Daniel Cerda of LISC.
Hi.
So, okay, Lisa, something that you like to talk about in this kind of conversation is people doing what you call hard things.
Hard things, exactly. So two of the other award winners that we like to give the award to for what I call hard things would be for the Casey Home Rehabber Loan Fund. It was given for the Richard Nadeau Organizational Achievement Award. And precisely what this involved was AltCap partnered with Legal Aid of Western Missouri. Sounds exciting, doesn't it?
Yes, very.
They did hard things where AltCap worked with local funders to come up with seed money to provide gap financing to be able to retain contractors. They then worked with Legal Aid of Western Missouri, who then worked with neighborhoods to help come up with clearance of titles for specific problematic properties in their neighborhoods. And for those of us that understand—
So when you talk about problematic properties, what are we talking about? We're talking about boarded up houses, things like that?
Very often, and Daniel will be very familiar with this, it is a tremendous problem that has been faced in our community, in all neighborhoods throughout the United States, problematic properties that can arise from deaths in families where there is not clearance of title and the home just continues to deteriorate in the neighborhood. Neighborhoods are hamstrung because they don't have access to it, yet it's affecting, it's becoming a blighting influence, or you cannot even locate the family members to even begin to address the issue, and many, many issues beyond that. But this program is designed to empower these neighborhoods to actually cause the change, dealing with significant legal challenges that most neighborhoods don't have that expertise to help clear those titles, pair that with money to begin to resolve those blighting influences in those neighborhoods.
So it's not always the sexy old firehouse becomes an art gallery?
It is not. But preservation is all about neighborhoods, and they are doing the hard thing of getting out there and figuring out legally and financially coming up with a program that would help make a difference in these neighborhoods.
Why do you like to draw attention to the fact that these are hard things? Like, what does that mean to you?
What that means to me is that I often find that most preservation projects, all very well-meaning and all very exciting, we like to call attention to it, are the ones that we all drive by. See the construction workers out there. They're wonderful historic buildings. Everyone's excited to see the change. But it's these other projects that are doing just as important work in historic neighborhoods that are really the unsung heroes that really make a difference, often in many ways that are very intangible, most often unseen, and in many respects can have an even broader impact on a greater volume of resources and impact so many other lives.
Daniel, jump in here.
It takes resources to get this work done. And so I think one of the things that, again, people don't often understand is with older buildings in particular, which are essentially they've become liabilities. They're not being maintained. They're being neglected. They're seen as eyesores. It takes an infusion of capital and energy to get those buildings going again. And preservation makes that possible through historic tax credits, which are administered both at the state and the federal level. And the tax credits have played a fundamental role in transforming the urban core in Kansas City, downtown especially, but also urban neighborhoods on both sides of the state line by actually making it possible and making it financially feasible for these buildings to be restored and put to another use.
Does Kansas City have a particular relationship with historic preservation and especially with adaptive reuse? But I guess like a particular kind of attitude toward its historic architecture, toward what buildings tell us about our past? Or are we just living out kind of the same story arc as other American cities right now?
Well, I really think it's been a little bit of both. I mean, we have a long history, but, you know, preservation has very early roots in Kansas City, dating back to the 1960s. I did volunteer work for Historic Kansas City when I was in college many, many years ago. And, you know, there's been an active base of preservation activity, but I really think it's kind of come to a crescendo at a certain level in terms of activity and actual number of projects over the last 10 or 15 years.
Well, with all movements evolve over time. In the 60s and the 70s in particular, preservation was the Kennedys was the chic thing to do, and there was a lot of money available. There was federal dollars available to the National Trust for Historic Preservation to do tremendous amount of cash outlays to do a lot of preservation work.
Why was that chic?
It was the time the Kennedys were quite suave. Jacqueline became heavily involved in preservation in New York, and it became the thing to do. And it was a tremendous boon to the whole movement and brought a lot of spotlight to it. But, you know, with all movements, things changed. And over time, we became more sophisticated in terms of bringing preservation into the mindset of not only it's about neighborhoods, it's also about public policy. And over time, preservation is now becoming more commonplace in the conversation in city halls and at government levels that when you are talking about planning issues in commercial districts or in neighborhoods, preservation issues, although you may not call them that, issues of rehab and restoration and neighborhood conservation are preservation.
Daniel, any care to make any predictions about the next type of building to need dramatic adaptive reuse?
There are a lot of industrial buildings that need really creative thinking, not just older historic warehouses that are over a century old, but typically the benchmark for historic is 50 years old. And I joke all the time that people forget that that's not that long ago.
Not that long ago. Well, the future is here and history was not that long ago. And we're excited to find out how people transform all these old industrial buildings. Not old, mature.
Mature, but bringing them into new, vibrant use.
Well, Daniel Cerda, Lisa Lassman-Briscoe, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Today's show was produced by Melody Rowell and Coy Duggar. I'm Gina Kaufman. Tomorrow we'll be back with a show on the changing landscape of journalism as the paper of record continues to shrink. What's taking its place in Kansas City and beyond? That's tomorrow on Central Standard, which keeps going strong thanks to you.